miembros de staff, el policía que va al campo, después la agenda de front of us.
Welcome to the so agenda item number one done. Any apologies, secretary?
Good morning, chairperson, honorable members, guests. We received two apologies for today's meeting. The first one is from Ms. Ntlangwini, who is still off sick. Second one is from Mr. Kwankwa. Ms. Peters indicated that she will be joining the meeting a little bit later. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We are having a presentation from the Human Sciences Research Council. Please, we'll allow you to do that, but we don't want to give you a lot of time with your presentations. We always prefer to engage so that we then deal with the issues that you are raising. Let me be a little bit democratic. How much time do you need? I saw your slides there.
We have 30 minutes. We won't show them all, chapters.
Yeah.
We will try and highlight the... So is it okay if we go for about an hour, Chair?
Okay, why don't I say 45 minutes?
Okay.
Let's go 45 minutes, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay.
Please introduce your team and then take the committee through your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for asking us to make this presentation this morning. We really appreciate that. So I'm Crane 13 and I'm the CEO of the HSRC.
Good morning. My name is Lakhne Simbai. I'm the Deputy CEO.
I'm Charlene Swartz, Executive Director of Education and Skills.
I'm Leslie Bank, and I'm in Economic Performance and Development.
Good morning, Terry Davis, Democracy, Governance, and Service Delivery.
Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you. I'm Priscilla Reddy, and I'm from the Deputy Executive Director for Health.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. So we'll dive straight in, if you don't mind, Chair. So. We've asked each of our presenters, so our colleagues are going to present from each of the major units inside of the HSRC. And we've asked them not to do all of the slides, but to do highlights only. And so we're going to start with our economics presentation, and we'll move from the economics to health to education. And then we'll end off, Chair, with a section on what the public is thinking around the key issues that arise here. And we're very happy to take discussion and comments, even on slides that we won't be presenting on, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Leslie Banks. I'm in economic performance. Some of my colleagues, Ivan Turok, Peter Jacobs, and Justin Tassati, who are more macroeconomic specialists in our unit, are all either on sabbatical or overseas at the moment. So I have consulted with them, assembled some slides, I'll highlight those points with you. I might not be able to take all the technical questions, but I'll do my best, okay? So the first slide really is a response from people in our unit, a concern about, I think it's been raised in the media, about the kind of potential debt to GDP that is represented in the budget projections. Which could reach 70% of GDP within 3 years. The debt, as noted in that chart, has been under 50% in 2015, 2016, and so there is a faster than normal rise in the debt projection, which our economists have noted out. The implication is a looming debt trap, where servicing the debt...
Sorry, could I was definitely waiting for you. I can see that we are already in the meet. I thought you were going to start, CEO, but saying what's the purpose of this presentation? What do you want to achieve and so on, right? Before you take us to the class and so on,
okay.
Right? Please talk to that.
Okay, so what I'm going to highlight here a little bit is that a lot of our work has been in the area of service industry, higher education innovation, and that is in line with some of the new direction that Treasury has taken on economic transformation, inclusive growth and competitiveness. So one of my points was that our work in the unit is quite aligned to this focus area. I was going to highlight a study that we have recently undertaken in Gauteng, which shows service sector growth being quite aggressive, and primary and secondary industries declining in that economy. So we have explored the possibilities of expanded tradable services and produced some important work on that, showing what the potential is there, whether that service sector growth can be very inclusive, can generate, it has inclusive sectors, and it also has high knowledge intensity sectors. But the tourism, retail, and other areas are more on the inclusive and easy access side, where the other, obviously engineering services, software development, and so on require high levels of skills. So there's a misconception there that around that service sector growth necessarily is high skilled, inaccessible, and exclusive, and that some of that research challenges that. The second thing I was going to bring to your attention was the importance of seeing our higher education institution as incubators of smart growth, precinct development, economic drivers. So this came up in the State of the Nation address around the need for new cities with technology. The argument really emerging from our research is that within our cities we have precincts that have the potential to drive new areas of growth. And I personally have done a book, two books actually, in the last year that explore some of those issues in relation to South African sector. We also want to draw to your attention the question of urban and rural urbanization, urban and rural migration. So we've just produced a new book on this issue of migration in South Africa. So we're seeing that urbanization rates are increasing and that the country is going through an urban transition. But we also noticed the following thing. We noticed that there is considerable investment occurring in home building in rural areas. We see that former homeland towns in many of these areas are changing and are quite dynamic nodes of non-agrarian economic development around sectors such as construction, financial services, etc. And these don't seem to appear as mainstream themes in economic planning documents. In fact, the narrative of spatial inequality that we have is disguising some of these important differences. The former homelands are poor, they're part of a legacy of bad policies, they are something of the past. Yet we've seen quite a lot of new change and development in these areas, and we are appealing to you to take note of some of the research that we've done in that area. We also feel that this, often one looks at areas like, let's say, somewhere like Joslovo Park, the informal settlement here. It's quite an internally differentiated area. So there are opportunities there, as obviously, as well as problems. So if one classifies all these areas just as aggregate, poor, problematic areas, one misses identifying what the opportunities are. And some of our research is showing that texture. So that, I think I'm going to stop there, except, I guess, finally to say that my colleagues have asked me to make the case to the committee to drive a economic census in South Africa, where we investigate the state of firms, jobs, in a much more specific way, because we understand social service delivery inequalities quite well on the basis of the kind of research that we do, but not necessarily the textured landscape of our economy. And support for that, which I think is already an idea within Treasury that is being driven, my colleagues would support that. So there you are. I didn't go through any of my slides, but that is a synopsis of what I wanted to say.
So I'm wondering, Chairperson, if I can't ask Leslie to actually just go back to that first slide around just the major comment that we're making here about this debt to
So the two critical points on the midterm budget speech really is that the looming debt trap and the rapid escalation of debt would be spiraling debt would be the worrying sign that my colleagues have asked me to highlight. The second thing is that the public wage bill spending, which is the next slide, is 35% of state spending. So the consequences that public servants have had a 66% increase in salary overall over the past 10 years, that the number of civil servants that earn more than R1 million has doubled since 2006. So one of the key points here is that more and more state money is going into the wage bill, which leads to a shrinkage. In fact, they estimate an 8% shrinkage over the past 8 years in terms of what can be spent directly on the delivery of basic services. So with a low growth outlook, less profit from tax, less earnings from employees, this trend is likely to continue. So those are sort of very specific comments from the Thanks.
Good morning. I think I'm also going to summarize the slides rather than go through every slide, and we'll be able to take some discussion on the broad aspects of health. So I think the appeal to the committee is to look at health from two angles: what's there and what we can do better, and what's not there. So from this perspective, I would like to talk a little bit on tobacco control, and that's, as we all know, South Africa has made some major gains, but those gains are being quickly unmade, and there are various reasons for that. The industry has already changed its tactics. We need to look at what's driving tobacco use, what interventions we have, what interventions we don't have. And I think, as it pertains to you, there's an important intervention that's on the book right now. That's the bill. And the bill, if it's facilitated and passed quickly, will make a major dent in the use of e-cigarettes, which is what pushes NCDs. We can talk about that more later, but that's the important issue in tobacco. Also in tobacco, what we see is that we have these major drops. We maintained our drops, but definitely among girls now, both smokeless tobacco and usual tobacco use is going up, and we need to look at that very, very quickly. But the other, next slide, Charlie. The other important thing is NCDs, and we know that tobacco behavior is one cause of NCDs that can just be removed through various aspects. So the HSRC has done some work in non-communicable diseases. I know that HIV is part of the NCD, but as we know, due to our history, much of the budget has always spent on HIV, whether it's on prevention, treatment, care, screening. What we're appealing to you is to get government and to get a budget to seriously look at things like diabetes and hypertension. The added point is that as you survive with HIV, due to government's almost 80% investment in treatment, you're going to encounter these diseases. Next slide. I'm trying to go as quickly as possible. Another important area in health is, as we know what our pyramid is like, is youth and behaviors that place young people at risk of poor health, both while they're young and adolescent, and as they move into adulthood and some of these behaviors become well entrenched. And there are various behaviors there that you could look at in the slide, but what we're finding is that research among for youth and the health aspects of youth, the social health aspects of youth, funding is just not available, and we need to look at that, because without evidence we can't develop programs that can be evaluated and tested. Next slide. And on this slide, we just discussed what happens if you don't have good data. Evidence has to drive what we're doing. Next slide. Next slide. As we know, we've got 7.9 million people infected with HIV. We know, next slide, the government has invested a major amount of money, up to 80% of the HIV treatment, care, and prevention budget. But the external funds are drying up, and we're going to need to look at how we're investing in AIDS. The important note here is that more and more young people are being infected, and more young people are not seeking treatment for HIV and AIDS. and we need interventions to look at that, because if we don't treat those young people, both the morbidity and the mortality burdens will increase, and we'll find that the rates of deaths due to HIV is going to go up. Next slide, please. And this is kind of just showing gaps. While we improve, while we are spending a major amount of money on antiretroviral therapy, we're still finding that 30% of the people living with HIV and AIDS are not initiating the treatment, even though it's there in many instances. And there's several reasons and barriers for that. No time to do that now. Next slide. Again, this is the slide where we talk about, and you can read at your leisure, what are some of the recommendations that we're making, both for NCDs and their determinants, and HIV and their determinants. Next slide, please. This is some comparative work that's been done between South Africa and Uganda on community-based, and my colleague will...
So good morning. Sorry for rushing in here late. I got caught in traffic. I must say thank you to your win. That took at least 5 minutes off the time, and I got you just in the nick of time. So my apologies to everyone. So here we are. So just to follow on what my colleague has said about HIV, and particularly the 30% that we're losing, 30% of people who are not initiating treatment, those are the hard to reach. And I think one of the key considerations as you think about health is how to improve efficiencies. And I think what our work is showing, what our work is telling us, and what we want to offer you is, as we think about health in this next period of time, we think about rolling out the NHI, we think about our systems which are crumbling and struggling under the burden of all these diseases, we want to offer the thought that perhaps we need to think about partnerships with communities, think about community-based delivery of services in support with health as a possible solution to some of the problems that we've seen. So we've been doing this work for the last 5 years in rural KwaZulu-Natal and in Uganda, testing different models of delivering antiretroviral treatment, either in the home or from mobile clinics, initiating ART in the community, providing refills and monitoring, and linking those people back to the government system. So it's a really an important partnership between government and community in terms of how to reach these much more difficult 30% that are not getting on treatment and staying on treatment. And we think we find important people. We find men who are reluctant, who don't come forward for a whole range of reasons for health services. We find young people who are living with HIV who need to get into treatment and on treatment. So really are offering you just a thought about the importance of thinking about, in this next period, thinking about combining health facility services with community-based delivery of antiretroviral treatment, and it could be a model for other things.
The slide is not up here right now, but there is a slide somewhere there on the NHI, the National Health Insurance. The HSRC has a history. There we go, that's it. The HSRC has a history of being involved in various NHI planning and thinking through activities. And as we know, late last year, again, the president created a task team, the NHI War Room, for implementation. Now, that stream, that NHI, the War Room situation, has 12 streams. And one of the streams is an economic stream. And a colleague of ours, or a couple of colleagues of ours, were working on that economic stream. And essentially what they're trying to do is they're trying to do a benchmarking exercise to look at what were primary health care or community health care at the clinic level cost. And in the next slide, you'll see that they list a whole lot of staff, equipment. It's a very, very busy slide. But the important thing to say is, A, they're looking at local data, B, they're looking at various costing models, and C, that they are working with the models that Treasury has also looked at. And in addition, because the United Kingdom has the National Health Service, they're working with consultants who have done similar work in the UK. So if you look at, and this is all work in progress, so if you look at the data they're already using, they're finding that in some instances, or in many, many instances, the actual expenditure is higher than the amount, and that's the red figures there, that's budgeted. Now, that could be for several reasons. But two important reasons would be, one, due to inefficiencies, and inefficiencies can be defined in many ways at person, place, equipment level, or it could be that the budgets that we put forward are just not enough. And so this costing work is continuing to go ahead. This is just some early data and some early analysis. I think that's the important thing to say about NHI right now. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk a bit about a topic which has perhaps been on all of our minds for the last while, and that's how do we as a country begin to respond to this issue of gender-based violence and femicide. By now I think most of us are aware of some of the factors that might be pointing us to the crisis that we have around this problem. Perhaps it has to do with our brutal and dehumanizing history, the ways in which this country and its resources and its riches came to be positioned in the hands of a few and taken away, perhaps in violent ways, from others. But there's a sense in which violence shapes and is in our DNA as a country. It is the kind of place we go to solve all kinds of things and issues. It's linked to issues of inequalities like unemployment, and all a range of inequalities. And I think the big issue is it's evident in many ways, the lack of safety and respect that women experience, the sense in which women do not feel that they have autonomy over their bodies. Those bodies belong to others, mostly men. The extent and brutality against women, children, and gender and gender minorities. And the sense of impunity, the sense in which this violence against women and children and gender and sexual minorities, seems to go on unabated without any consequences. And that's the moment, that's the crisis that we're in. The HSOC is part of this broader task team looking at how do we develop a whole of society approach in addressing this particular problem. And the kind of four or five steps that are outlined on that slide, getting a sense of the magnitude of the problem, trying to understand this history of institutionalized violence, the ways in which violence permeates our society, in our families. It's a way of coping, a way of doing, a way of understanding who we are as a nation. We need to do more about that. Trying to get a much more accurate read on the overall levels of crime and violence, and developing this whole of society approach. And I think that in the current budget statement, it makes some provisions for doing a couple of things. The next slide, please, Charlene. And I think one of the things that it wants to do in the next 3 years, which we fully support, is to strengthen coordination and collaboration between government departments working on this issue. So what happens, as happens in government, as happens in our institution, we all tend to work in silos. So justice is, and correctional services is dealing with the issue of GBV. Education is doing something. Department of Social Development is doing something. So in the next 3 years, this proposal to really strengthen the conversation, the communication, the coordination between these groups in government that are doing things around this problem is really, really important. I think also really important under that strengthening and coordinating piece is to better equip those government employees who are tasked with providing support, tasked with doing something around this, providing support to those who might be victims of this kind of violence, strengthening their capacities and their ability to do that. I think one of the big plugs we make in the red blocks on, block on the right hand, on the left-hand side, is really deepening our understanding of this particular problem and our knowledge. We have some good guesses. A lot of it is underreported. But the extent to which, what are the kind of drivers in society that seem to be deepening and exacerbating this particular problem? Why do we in South Africa have such a problem with this relative to other countries in the world? We need to know more. We need to document this more. We need to find places of putting together these systems of knowledge and understanding for interventions, for strategies, for things we can do to prevent gender-based violence and femicide. But I think what I want to talk about is perhaps the green box, which talks, you can't really see it, but it talks about breaking new ground and the things we have to do there, addressing gender-based violence, stopping violence before it begins. But I think the most important point it's making there is this fact that it requires something from all of us. I think for the longest time, in response to gender-based violence, we have all thought that this was a solution that government had to find. And I think we're reaching the point in this country where we're realizing that work needs to happen on a lot of other levels. It most importantly must happen on that personal level. Gender-based violence is not something out there. It is in here, in this room, in our homes, in our institutions, in our relationships. in our society, and so that responsibility, that whole of society responsibility, starts with us.
The media-term budget statement says that education is... The media-term budget statement, colleagues, correctly highlights that education should be one of our largest things. And there's a lot to be said about education, and I'd like to make 2 points around education. The first is that we need to prioritize how we spend the money we do have in education. And I say that because of the two things that have come out quite strongly, certainly in the State of the Nation address, but also in the budget statement, and that is this issue of robotics and coding from grade R to grade 9. And the second is this notion of tablets for young people in schools. And the reason I want to use that as the thing to just show you that we are used to seeing South Africa at the bottom of tables, leagues and log tables. So that graph up there, we always tend to be doing really poorly when it comes to maths and science. But the thing that we don't often see is the next graph, which is how we've improved over the last 12 to 16 years. We have improved incredibly. We've done the best out of all the countries that have been tested in terms of getting our scores higher and higher and increasing it. And how have we done that? We've been trying to get the basics right. Writing, reading, literacy, and basic comprehension and understanding amongst young people. So for us, it's really important from an evidence point of view that we keep doing the basics right and that we don't jump to things like robotics and coding before young people can reason and have the confidence to engage with robotics and computers. The other graph that you may not have seen is something that we do in our TIMS study that happens every few years, and that is access to ICT, to computers. We're probably one of the few countries in the world where our access to computers in our schools is going down because our teachers don't know how to upkeep of computers. We know that it gets stolen. We know that when a computer gets corrupted with viruses or whatnot, teachers just don't know what to do, and so the computers sit in a head's office under lock and key. So before we go into coding and robotics, we've got to get those basics right. The basics around infrastructure, including cryptography, but also ICT, and the basics around just keeping on plugging on getting our literacy levels and our mathematical levels up. So this last slide is a really important one because it also connects with what some of my colleagues have said about community engagement. We all know that reading to our children from a young age helps with their cognitive development. But it's become a bit of a middle class thing. Parents are under huge amounts of stress. They don't often have books in the home. But some of our research is showing that it's not just reading. It's playing traditional games with sticks and rocks. It's singing songs with your children. It's things that we can actually help school parents, parents and schools to understand that actually any of those activities will help to develop the reasoning and the writing and the basic skills that we need before we go on to something like robotics and coding. And so our research shows the relationship between how much time a parent spends or a caregiver or a grandmother spends in that interaction with children and how that could become a very nice community initiative to ensure that young people attain to the kinds of levels that we want in order to grow our country and to enter the fourth industrial revolution without the big gap that we're all so afraid of, that middle class kids are going to be streets ahead of young people who are struggling in poorer schools. The second point I wanted to make was just some research that we've done on the public sector, public service sector. And one of the things that we've found in our research is that there be a number of posts that have been frozen across the board, and that is probably the most unhelpful thing that Treasury can do. Because what it does is it doesn't get to the root of the problem. And in this research study, people have both said and have spoken about colleagues that many people act with impunity and do not do their work because they have political connections and they're not afraid of losing their jobs. So colleagues, that's a very serious claim to make from our research study, and I wouldn't have had the courage to make it unless it was from a research study. But this notion of non-performing incumbents in positions acting with impunity is really critical, and it means that we really must deal with that problem rather than just a wage freeze across the board.
And then the final piece, point is, again, we hear a lot about young people being helped with entrepreneurial skills, but what it does is it hides some of the things that we're thinking that we should be doing around youth employment, and that is to think about all of the technological changes that are coming down the line, platform economies, robotics, digitization, machine learning, and thinking about how each of those technologies are going to disrupt and drive the possibility for future employment. And so what we think about is we think about skilled and unskilled work, entrepreneurial versus business as usual work, but in a sense it might be more helpful to think about all of those technologies able to drive work for young people in ways that we haven't thought of before. So this is a piece of research that we're currently busy working on, but the orange economy is something around leisure and culture and creative economy that you may not have been able to make a living from in the past, but now through platform technologies and being able to get small amounts of money for playing the saxophone or taking photographs or whatever, it can actually become a form of a livelihood for young people. We're bringing the blue economy, community service and public service, NGO work can become a huge driver and growth because it employs so many people already. But can we start to think about young people and their livelihoods in terms of a multiplicity of spaces in which they can have entrepreneurial jobs, skilled jobs, unskilled jobs, and everything else in between? So for us, it's really important that we help develop these mechanisms for young people. Not the YES program, which is great, but we need to all be thinking more expansively about the numerous sectors in which young people can find work, employment
livelihoods
in the future.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about the South African Social Attitude Survey to give voice to vulnerable South Africans. Now, I think even though some of the information I'm going to share with you may sound not new, but I think it's important because the study reflects on a scientific survey which gives us an idea about how the broader South Africa thinks. So I'm going to just focus. I'm going to go straight to slide 52 and 53, which speaks to some of the issues Charlene has mentioned, because I think it's more logical flow. So if you look at slide 52, which speaks to the fourth industrial revolution, the survey has measured attitudes towards automation. The previous one, So you will see we've asked people in that particular slide, how comfortable are you, for example, using certain examples, just to give you an idea about the readiness of the South African population. So if we talk about things that we sort of think, if a robot performed an operation with you, you would see a large sector of the population, 67%, say they're very uncomfortable, which is a score from 1 to 4, and then moderately comfortable, 5 to 6, is 19%, and comfortable, 7 to 10, 14%. Now just to highlight the other examples, so where workers fear that their job may be replaced by robots, again, a large proportion, 66%. Receive goods delivered by a drone or a robot, 59%, similarly a large proportion. Being driven in a driverless car in traffic, now these are examples, but it shows that people are still fearful of technology. And keep in mind that the survey has been conducted with adults 16 and older, so this is the older population. So a newer generation which Charlie speak to may be a little bit different, but it points out that we need to do more in terms of not only creating access, but also creating a situation where people are not fearful of using technology. So looking at the next slide, which speak to, how worried are you over the next 10 years that your job might be lost in terms of replacing a computer? If you compare South Africa in the third bar chart there, 62% said they're very or quite worried. Now compare that to 10% in the UK. So, and vice versa, 28% says they're not very worried or not at all worried compared to 81% in the UK. So clearly we have work at hand here to do. Now let's focus on whether people think government are capable or ready to kind of manage this process to prevent job losses. Mm-hmm. Now if you look at that slide just next to it, you will see we disaggregated this by poverty status. This is self-defined poverty, where the people describe themselves as poor, just getting by, and non-poor.
But if you look at the South African proportion, 37% said they're very or fairly confident. But a large proportion, 57% says they're not very or not at all confident their government can do that. Now, if you turn this to the non-poor, 43% says they are very or fairly comfortable, which is by far the largest proportion compared to the poor in this different part. So you can see there's a gradient with economic status and class that the more you better off, the more comfortable you feel that government can do this. So these are just two slides in terms of the industrial, fourth industrial revolution, which I wanted to highlight. But now turning back, and unfortunately, I'm going to speak very quickly to the slide, but it's important to look at the slide for the public opinion. So sorry, just I'll run through slide 44 to go back to that. So in terms of the general perception, attitudes, and behavior of the public with regards to, and I'll speak quickly to this, to satisfaction with democracy. Now you will see that, I'll just look at the green line. Satisfaction towards democracy has been climbing since 2003 to 2017. If you draw a straight line down. There's a story to be told quite early. If you look at 2018, the line goes up. But we've been speculating about this. Future round surveys will indicate whether we can sustain that, whether we can address our challenges to move that curve upward. And it's really early days to say whether that is change of government. But the other slides also point to that. So if you look at the next slide, which is how satisfied are you with the general economic conditions. Now you would see again that slide also shows a steep decline where people are not happy. Although in 2018 the line goes up, and this is consistent with GDP measures. It's kind of mirrors that. So I think our data speaks quite well to the fact that people's perceptions of the general economic conditions, that they're really on the point. In the next slide, I'll summarize that quickly. In terms of people's perceptions, in terms of satisfaction with government-provided services, if you look at the basic services in terms of satisfaction with the supply of water and sanitation, electricity, garbage removal, you will see, I should have drawn a line there, but the last 3 or 4 years, that's a downward trend. So certainly this speaks to some of the service delivery process that we've been having. And the biggest fall is the electricity from 72% to 54%, which is a fall of 50%. So that's quite significant. And the biggest concern is if you look at crime, it is a big concern. In 2018, 22% was satisfied with crime. Similarly, on the next slide, another big concern, as we know, is employment, unemployment. That's been below the 10% for consistently since 2000, or around the 10% since 2000 to 2018. The only good news, and I think we all know that, social grants is very positively evaluated. People are very satisfied with the fact that satisfied with that. So, you know, that is something to be positive about. And then, looking at trust in national government and parliament, it's clear there that the line is on the downward trend. Trust in parliament is going down, although you can see the proportion of trust in parliament, or trust very much, is lower than, for example, national government. But in 2018, it seems to be an upward surge from more people are satisfied with parliament as opposed to national government. However, we need to kind of also look at this further. But the big message is that trust is going down. And on the next slide, if you compare trust going down in parliament and in government, while corruption is on the up. Now, this is a question that we've asked people. Please mention the 3 most important challenges in South Africa, just to give you an idea. The top challenge was unemployment. The second one was crime and safety. And poverty was the third one. But corruption hovered around the fourth place. And corruption was in 23, as you see, 9% the issue. But if you look where we are now, even though it's 23%, it's still a major issue. But there is signs, as I said, it's a good story, that certain people think that something is being done. However, we also know during the past year, people want to see action, people want to see maybe some issues being implemented about the Zondo Commission, etc. So we want to see whether if that can be sustained. Certainly we want a good track. So just the next slide to kind of summarize. We have also asked questions about xenophobia and also migration. I think this is important to reflect how the public at large feel. What is really worrying, we've asked people a question about
How would you take part in a violent action to prevent immigrants from living or working in your neighborhood? Now, that's quite a very difficult and sensitive question to ask. So we also do acknowledge there may be underreporting in this particular question. It's a sensitive question. However, if we look at the results and the options were pre-coded, people were saying they have done it in the past year, they have done it in the distant past, they have not done it but might do it, and they have not done it. So larger proportions have never done it, and they won't do it. But worryingly is that those who said they have not done it, but they may do it, and that's 10% of the population for all those years from 2015 to 2018. Now, if you look at the real numbers in terms of the statistics, I mean, just look at 2017, so that would be, if you times that with, let's just see the real number there in 2018, that would be almost 310,000 people. It's quite large numbers. So these are worrisome. The next slide. So now we ask, you know, what do South Africans think can be done to stop these attacks and to be on the positive side? So just looking at the category in terms of attitudinal change, community dialogue, and educational awareness, these are some of the things that people cited verbatim. In other words, these were their responses and categorized into these categories. South Africans said that we need to change our attitude towards immigrants or people from foreigners from other countries. We also need to, you know, have dialogues, 5% indicated that. And then educational and awareness campaigns were a large proportion, 11% mentioned that. However, if you're looking at the immigration factors, there's a strong sentiment that eviction and the removal of immigrants, 22% the proportion indicated that. And this go hand in hand with stronger border control and border measures, which is about 11%. There were also sentiments that foreigners should change their behavior. So, and that was at 8%, the proportion. But then if you're looking at the last category, which we've clustered in others, was also kind of related to border management, but then these are looking at law enforcement must be implemented more stricter. A large proportion of 13% indicated that. The resource management, a 10% proportion indicated that. This is more about where people in the communities feel that South Africans don't get their fair share of the resources, whereas foreigners get more of the resources. So these are some of the issues, just to close, that I wanted to share with you, to contextualize some of the findings that my colleagues have presented. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to my colleagues. So, Chair, this is what we prepared in response to your request that we come here to provide an overall assessment of the budget speech, and to give you a sense of the work which is going on inside of the HSRC in relation to all of these. So we're very happy to take any comments you may wish to make and answer questions, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, CEO and your delegation. Let me hear from the honourable members. Okay, one comrade, Honourable Kumane, Sheikh Joseph, Sarapen, Matafa, Zembo. Peters, Tihale. Thank you. Let's start. Why don't we limit ourselves to at least three questions, and so that we can give others a chance. If we still have time, we'll take a second bite. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. One would ask the following questions, maybe for clarity. On the issue relating to the fourth industrial revolution, which sectors, in terms of representation, do you think the government should maybe invest on so that it can maybe expect maximum benefit? And then The second one, still on NHI. In your view of the performance of the NHI, are there any positive results yield, or what are the lessons learned from that? Chairperson, as per your request, the last question, maybe one would come for a second bite. And what is your position? Granted the concerns of NHI versus the affordability at the present moment. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honourable Sheikh.
Thank you, Chair. You know, Chair, when you were a bit late, we were decided that we wanted to continue, elect the chairperson and continue. But somebody ruled us out of order, so...
Honourable Sheikh.
Yeah, thank you. Manja, you know, we talk about the debt to GDP. Now, I want you to tell us, for many years, we particularly in this committee have been complaining about the rising debt. And everybody that came and did their presentation gave us an impression, nothing to worry about, to be honest with you. They kept comparing us to other countries and their debt to GDP. Suddenly we get a minister now coming and saying we are in a crisis situation, we are about to reach that fiscal cliff, which is the term we've been using. So I want you to comment on that and tell us, what do you think is going to happen if we continue in this run? Because we have been saying, you know, if this thing rises to the extent it is rising, we're going to reach a fiscal cliff, we're going to be in serious trouble, we're going to be dependent on borrowing more and more and more, and eventually we'll be technically insolvent. That's the term I should use. Now, I want you to tell us honestly, in your observation, because there's a whole lot of talk going out in terms of the NHI. What is your interpretation or understanding of how this NHI is going to be rolled out, number one? And do you believe we are ready, or what is going to prevent us from successfully rolling out the NHI at this stage, given all the circumstances, the maintenance, the availability of resources, the human resource, the maintenance of buildings, and all those things? Now, I want you to tell us whether the fact that, and we must not deny this, we have reduced the pass rate in schools to 30%. What impact is that having on us? Is it really, because it seems to be that the emphasis is on quantity rather than quality. So what are we actually producing? Because my understanding is even the African countries don't even want to accept any of our medical practitioners. They don't want any of them anymore. So what is the impact? Should we not be concentrating on providing quality education? Because if you go particularly to the rural areas, I want to tell you, a lot of these educators are not educators, they're childminders. That is what I call them, because they're not able to provide the quality education. Now, if the foundation is not correct, how do you expect these people to go? And I want to tell you where I'm coming from. You know, I talk to a lot of graduates here, and sometimes I give them certain things to do some research and to prepare. And I want to tell you, if you look at the quality, if you look at the spelling, if you look at the wording, man, it is shocking what we are getting. So I'm concerned about whether, if we want to prepare ourselves and deal with the inequality, education is one of the driving forces. And are we doing the right thing in terms of dropping the quality rather than enhancing the quality rather? I know I'm not talking for the executive here. And I know they're talking about cutting down their benefits and everything. Now, do you really believe that is really the way to go? Do you believe that is really going to help us in terms of cutting down on costs? Because for me, that's minimal at this point, to be honest with you. There are more serious problems that we picked up, like on the ground, with where you're losing, we're not getting value for money, losing hundreds of billions of rands. We as members of parliament, we don't have constituency offices. There's a whole lot, and I see we're just targeting the executive there. I'm not sure if that... Now, gender-based violence, I want to come to that one. The statistics that was provided by South African Police Services and StatsSA found that most of these crimes are committed late at night during the early hours of the morning. And 80 to 90% of them is alcohol-related. Okay? Yet, we're not willing to deal with these taverns and shebeens where we're just providing licenses, they're open till 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock. Now, that is the root cause. you're not taking away the root cause. Together with the high unemployment rate, the socioeconomic conditions that they're living in, teenage pregnancy. Lastly, I want to talk about HIV. And I see you're not addressing that. Over 1,200 15 to 24-year-olds are newly infected every week in South Africa. Now, I want you to tell me the balance. On the one hand, we seem to be excited about this ART, ARV that we are rolling out. And I'm saying that is not the solution. We will need to prevent it. We need to stop our people from dying and be infected with HIV. So what do you believe we should do differently? Shouldn't the emphasis should be on prevention rather than treatment? Because all that's going to happen is going to escalate. The numbers are going up and up and up. I'll stop there for now, Chair. There's a whole lot more, but let me stop.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Dennis Joseph. Thank you for the presentation. I just would like to know if we are dealing now with obviously the national team, and if you use call centers or you have personal people that do this service, how do you get your information or the data? And also if you do, visit provincial legislatures or you just accountable to national. On page 18, I just want to ask a question about particularly the TB, which is a long history on TB in South Africa, which, if you just look at the current informal settlements, Chairperson, poverty, the conditions, electricity, water, not proper housing, I mean, all that contributes that we do not make improvements. I don't know what is the particular stats on TB, particularly in the Western Cape, not sure what other provinces, but I think as long as we have this conditions and urbanization, it would probably put pressure on people not be able to get help with the health situation due to that. On page 20, I just wanted to ask if the HIV status, I mean, HIV is also took off 10 years ago or so. I thought by now it is part of the curriculum. So you are recommending that more should be done, interventions at school age. But I would think by now, given the history that we have, it should be part of it. I don't know if it is. It doesn't look like it according to your information, page 20. Page 21, the health services and the studies in Uganda. Chairperson, I support this community-based centers that they're referring to, but some years ago, my wife was a nursing sister herself, going to factories with health services, where women even don't have to take off work. They get it there because men doesn't take this responsibility. Now, these things have been fallen by the wayside. So we must take the services to where the people are and not let thousands and thousands of people sit at clinics for hours. So I support it if that can be included, then we can get back to individuals taking responsibility, particularly the woman who's really being under pressure of that they have to take the responsibility, which is not necessarily should not necessarily be the case. On page 24, I just want to this thing about gender-based violence. Chairperson, my understanding from a Khoisan perspective is that this thing is deeply, deeply rooted, as I said in my speech the other day. Because this thing started with settlers and wars and discriminating laws in government and even cultures. Does culture shape people or does the people shape the culture? You know, we've got to be honest with these things. This is the real life, where we come from. And that means it's the cost to government, cost to the health department, cost to the justice system, cost to the courts. This is where it ends up. But we must be honest, this is deeply rooted things. This is not things that we, by laws, can only by laws change. That is why it shows not working. Because it's more than just laws. It's a total onslaught on I would say, the human rights of women as an equal person, human being that has a history that we actually have to deal with as well. And then on page 28, I just want to know what is your experience on the pilot project that the government did on the NSI? Because obviously, I'm sure you followed tracking that as well. And what is your experience on that? I think that would just assist me with going forward on that. And on the page last 137, Chairperson, I think there's two slides that speak directly to us here as members of parliament. And the one is the political connections of posts. I think, I'm sure the ruling party also speaks about it, we all speak about it, about the corruption politically connected, and I think that I'm glad that they are saying it to us. It's important that other people are also saying it to us. Because sometimes when we say it to ourselves and we don't listen to each other. Mm-hmm. And then the last point is I want to give the EFF credit here. Not very seldom I give them credit. But the slide that indicates there's an improvement of behavior in Parliament is to the EFF behavior in Parliament. Parliament, I think that I must give them the credit here. They're behaving, so that's why there's a slide that says that the public are seeing this and they actually feel much better as to when they look at Parliament nowadays. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just with regards to the slide 3, which is probably the most critical, my most critical takeaways was around the difference between the National Treasury forecasts and the actual trajectory of debt to GDP. What has been driving the difference between their forecast and the alarming growth? Has it mainly been around the bailouts and the additional borrowing to pay for bailouts? And then in terms of proactive remedies, I'd just like the HSRC's take on vertical versus horizontal industrial policy, because right now we seem to have a mishmash of both. That doesn't really seem to be working, so I'd just like to get some ideas around that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Now, thank you for the presentation. I'll start first by emphasizing what Honorable Sheikh is raising around the importance of the foundation phase. So with the Chair, I think it cannot be overemphasized the importance that early childhood development has in the overall education and development of children. I'd want to solicit a view from yourself if whether is there enough emphasis placed from the policy statement, if whether are we alive to that particular reality. And Chair, linked to that is the presentation made on slide after 34, I suspect that is 35, on the issue of maybe emphasizing more focus on numeracy, is it literacy, you put them on here. Yeah, writing, reading, numeracy, and reasoning more than robotics and so forth. My question would be, do we think that it cannot be done simultaneously? Because I suspect that if we consider only the basics, we might lose out on the global development, because it's not like the world is going to wait for us to improve these basic skills. The enhancement of technology will continue being on the movement. So I think maybe what we should consider is it possible, whilst we look at the soft skills, can we incorporate basic computing skills and also at a lower level? I mean, Chair, as much as you always say that I missed out on experiencing apartheid, at some stage I did. At primary level in townships, we were forced to go and study woodwork, bricklaying, and welding. Mm-hmm. At the primary level. But obviously the objective was not to skill us, was to make us compliant to instructions and to build these things, not to design them. So I'm asking, at this level, what is your view in terms of introducing practical assistance skills at a lower level? Maybe look at how we can enhance the syllabus of teaching. Chair, the last one is on the issue of protest as well as the level of satisfaction as far as service delivery is concerned. I just can't find my notes here, but I'll speak to it. What I've realized is that a service delivery protest has the ability to draw more participants than a government public meeting. where the objective is to have the communities being involved in planning and budgeting. Now, I have a view, and I would like you to assist me. If you had done a study on the accessibility of information by ordinary citizens on the work of government, how it plans, the role that ordinary citizens can play in assisting government, so to speak, becoming stakeholders. And I mean, our constitution is clear that public participation is central to how we govern. Mm. If you have done a study like that, do you think that we'll end up with this graph? Because I'm saying this, Chair, based on my experience when I was a public rep in local government, you will go into an area, public meeting, planning, prioritizing of projects, the community that is there will input, and then after a year down the line, the other section of the community will rise up and protest against what you are implementing, what was solicited from them, but at a larger scale, bigger than the meeting that was attended in prioritizing. So my interest would be to say, had we done a study of how as government we communicate our work and also the impact that our media has in terms of assisting us disseminate the information around our work we have on the satisfaction level. Because everyone can see that our media, in most cases, would hardly report the good work, particularly coming from government. But mainly it would be the issues that we are raising, issues of corruption, politically connected, and all of these things. Because their business is more on selling their publications than in the voters. I'll pause there, Chair. Thank you.
Honourable Sandro.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me also join other members in welcoming this presentation. First, Chairperson, as a preamble, one should indicate to the HSRC that this particular committee, Chair, has got a legal obligation in terms of appropriating the purse of the country. We may be a small committee, Chair, in terms of number and whatever, but in terms of the work that we have to do for the South African population. So when one begins to welcome your presentation, it goes with that. And having read your presentation last night and listened to you talking today, you know, one picked up some issues, but now Chair is restricting us to only three. I've tried to pick on those which you know my passion, where my passion lies. I can't be quiet on anything which talks to labor and labor relations. Now, Chair, I welcome the concerns and comments that the wage bill should be looked at. In fact, you are actually suggesting that the public sector wage bill needs pruning. That's what you are saying. Now, in which sector should this be done? I am worker biased. Let me put it up front as a gamer. Now, what is your suggestion there? Because listening to the medium-term budget workers were elevated into millionaires, which I personally don't believe is the case. Now, I don't know now, when you come with this one, that are you also following that notion that let's forget perhaps about the higher echelons, your management and whatever, and now focus to the ordinary workers when you are talking pruning. Also regarding that, in the context of the high unemployment percentage that is there in the country, we always run between 29 and 35 somewhere there. When we bring it down, it will go to 29. Now, you are talking pruning. We have got the vacancy rate where you have got organizational structures which are not filled in when I'm talking about the vacancy rate. Are you still talking pruning when you are talking about relook into the wage rate? And lastly, around this, looking at the priorities broadly, starting from the NDP, the presidential injunctions, whether you're talking SONA, whether you are talking whatever that the president has actually, you know, alluded to. Are you, or do you see realization of such whilst we are talking pruning of the public sector? Then the second one, Chair, I will be brief with this one, on NHI. As the country, we are all out. It's another disclaimer that, of course, there would be a few individuals who are anti-NHI. There are very few. We are about to make sure that we adopt the bill and it be enacted. Perhaps can you assist us just to throw some light as to the performance of NHI in terms of the pilot projects that have been thrown out in the various provinces? How is it performing? Particularly looking at the understanding that is underpinning NHI. You put it together, clap it together with what I'm saying. That I sit here, I see NHI as the messiah of the country when it comes to health standards, where there shall be equality of health regardless of one's test, whether the test is bigger or smaller. Because in essence, that is what the NHI is saying. Hence, you will find that those who are anti-equality, those who still want to see South Africa balkanized into the haves and the have-nots, would be totally against the NHI. Then the last one, Chair, would be, I read your slide 30. Your slide 30 is on its own recommendation. Let me just take that first bullet, because some of the issues have been, you know, somehow attended. You are talking the investments on interventions directed at school-age children to be aware of their HIV status. Now, in terms of trends, allocations of HIV awareness showing an increasing or decreasing trend over the past 5 years. Going back to the 2019 medium-term budget policies statement, do you see the budget allocated talking to that bullet? Allocations for HIV and AIDS awareness distributed equitably across provinces based on their demographic profile, like your rural versus urban,
whatever, say, have nots, have haves, and all that.
Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Once more, my apology for late arrival. And thanks to the HSRC for the presentation. Chairperson, like you've indicated, we probably have a challenge of time. But the disadvantage of arriving late is the fact that I might not have, or I might have missed out on the indications from the HSRC on the method that, or the procedures that they use to acquire the information and how the research that they conduct is carried out. So my apologies if my questions might be lacking in terms of substance of how you go about doing this work. There's only two areas, Chairperson, that I thought I need to speak to. The other one is, I think two of the colleagues, noted as well as Zembo, has spoken to this issue of the public servants who earn above the million rand. I think this thing has been branded around far too much, and it is going to create problems for our public servants, because it is not given context, Chairperson, that it could be the cost to the employer or to the state as opposed to what these particular public servants take home. Secondly, the other thing with regards to this 1 million the number of millionaires, has the research or the collection of your information given you an indication of the qualifications of this particular public servant? Some of them have been in the public service since number of years, and now primarily, and especially those who come from the previously disadvantaged groups, some of them are only now starting to qualify since 1994 for pensions and all other benefits that they never used to have access to. So obviously you'd find that the cost to the state will increase. But also the Public Service Commission gave us an indication of the levels at which our public servants are right now, the qualifications that they have acquired over the years. We do have in the public service people with doctorates, people with masters and all those. And if you do a comparison between the public sector and the private sector, you'd really find that some of them are underpaid. And I would want to say for us as members of parliament, we actually appreciate the fact that we've got this high level of qualified public servants and who want to remain public servants, because it would then say it translates into the quality of service that they can provide. Yes, it might not be visible right now, because you'd find that they are not necessarily those who are in the core phase of service delivery, but also with the necessary support, they could then be able to give those at the cold phase of service delivery the maximum type of support. The other thing is the issue of the wage bill. We are calling on the increase of the number of doctors and nurses, and I'm sure you would be aware that the doctors that do actually go into the public sector, some of them are even doing private sessions, and they get remunerated at levels that actually are commensurate with the qualifications that they have. So it does have a burden on the state, because you then have those who have got their private sessions, they are running their private practices, and they are now also doing sessions with the state. And it brings me, Chairperson, to the point of the NHI. It is actually this category of people who are anti-NHI, because Once the NHI is implemented, they would then lose the opportunity to continue raking in and getting additional income from the state. And these are the things that when we're dealing with whether the NHI is affordable or not affordable, we don't seem to be looking into. So I would really ask agencies like the HSRC in doing their studies to also do this particular type of comparisons. The other one, Chairperson, is related to HIV and AIDS and the young people. I just want to find out whether the fact that some of these young people might have been born with the virus have been factored into the report. Because you'd find that you pick it up at age 16, because now the immune system has been so weakened, and there are other factors, socioeconomic factors, that contribute to that type of situation. And then it's only at that point that it is picked up. But also it links up to the understanding and the education about sexuality. It is at that age that young people start realizing who they are in relation to the opposite sex. And probably that's also why it comes in. And I would want to ask the HSRC, what is your view with this so-called hullabaloo around sexuality and sex education? And that is, I, Chairperson, in reading into this thing, if I'm a teacher, I've never ever taught a subject of this nature. I'm not a health person, because initially sexuality and sex education would have been things that they encourage doctors or nurses to come and speak to children at school, because they seem to understand the anatomy of the human being better. But when the teacher who is now doing life skills or life orientation or whatever subject that they need to do has to be given the extra responsibility to teach or impart knowledge on sexuality, it is a shock to the teacher, because the teacher himself or herself has never been exposed to this. And now the teacher, coming from a very conservative environment where these things are not spoken to children, he or she is now expected to teach somebody's child, not his or her own child, about these things. Hang on, this person is not even able to talk to his or her own child about this matter. So it's a shock to her mentality, to his system, to want to teach and or to be able to teach. And that's why you find that the reaction comes mostly from teachers. The other one is the fourth industrial revolution. I don't know, one of the colleagues was saying, it's probably better for us to encourage for a multi-pronged approach. And I would also support that. As opposed to saying, are we ready? Don't we, Chairperson, with the previous life that I had the honor and the opportunity to visit Russia. And when we were there on that particular day, I got surprised to see a grade six being exposed to taking a washing machine. The other one was a microwave, the other one was a washing machine, the other one was some equipment, because I was watching these two, dismantling it to the last nut and putting it back together as a grade six. And that's why you'd find that sometimes it looks like we are lagging behind, because we want to say certain things are too fast. But I also have my own personal contradictions to say we are sitting in a country where we've got massive inequalities. As I'm seated here, I know there are children who don't have a toilet at the school, a toilet which unfortunately your system makes it impossible for you to send anybody. Even if you are how lazy, you have to go there. So these children don't have a toilet. And now you have to talk about coding. Coding versus access to the basics. These are some of the things that when we have to look at the priorities of our government and the priorities of our country, we need to be able to look at those particular things to say, hang on, what is it? And I think, Chairperson, in conclusion, The World Cup victory has taught us quite a lot. If you look at the history of Zia, he's a classical example of, even if given an opportunity, what then you can achieve. If he remained at the school at which he started, would he have an opportunity to lead the World Cup team in 2019? And I want to say to you, no, primarily because of the disparities that are there. Even if you work how hard, inequality is something that you can't erase or manage overnight. So I would want to say we need to also look at the where we are as a country 25 years down the line. I'm happy that there's an indication that some areas we're doing quite well, but some areas we're not doing well. Chairperson, and I want to say, the areas that we are doing well, we seem to want to hide them under the table. And there's nothing wrong for, I saw your team's thing there, why is the HSRC not talking publicly about this and explaining these type of things so that South Africans and others should know that even when there are areas that we are lagging behind, there are areas that we have improved. And that will be encouraging. And I'll go back to the World Cup. People are very encouraged to say, our children need sporting facilities that can actually elevate them, because they have seen that it can happen. And I'm saying that it is agencies like the HSRC that can help us to be able to say, like you have indicated, Honorable Member has now a different picture about the EFF in Parliament, because you have now given us that picture that there seems to be some decorum that is emerging in Parliament. So I, Chairperson, thank you very much, and apologies again for late coming.
No problem. Peters, we got to the apology. Thank you again, CEO and your team, for the presentation. Honorable Clara, Zosala, okay, that's fine. Come.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for getting me. Even in my province, these programs will run around the whole country, but they won't go to Limpopo. That is why you're forgetting me, joining them. Even the rugby team is to go. Never thought of visiting my province. But anyhow, there's no problem. Let me join my colleagues in thanking the presentation, and they have already touched on everything, actually. But I really want to request that when it comes to the program of NHI, I will request the HSRC people to at least make sure that they assist, that this program is not failing. I don't know how, but just assist that it's not failing, because the former minister and the present minister talked to all the traditional leaders in the Limpopo. If ever you want to see how tradition is being led, you go to my province, because that's where we have many traditional leaders who are practicing their tradition very good. That is why when it comes to even the program of initiation schools, you find that lives are being saved in the Limpopo. So they are ready for the program, and if it can fail, I don't think it will do good to them and their constituency, because after receiving the education or the information on the NHI, they went to their constituency, talked to the people, the Indunas, and the people on the ground, and they are ready for it. So my request is that let's assist each other so that it's not going to fail. Honorable Dibua touched on the issue of education. I'm just worried that there is this view that the learners are going to learn how to do everything that is being practiced in the bedroom, in the school, starting from grade 4 learners. So I'm really worried that when it comes to the youth and the risk behavior, then the parents, all of us, are going to go on the treatment of stress, depression, diabetic, and high blood, because we're going to lose the future of our kids because of this program. We are under the risk of alcohol in our areas, under the risk of this cigarette smoking and whatever, all these bad behaviors. We are under the risk of those behaviors. So if this program of education that we are hearing that is going to our learners, then truly speaking, they will remain alone because all the parents will be dead because of stress and all these diseases and this behavior. I'm just speaking the truth. So yeah, we need to come up with a tool that will end up assisting everybody, starting with those who are still coming. When it comes to the youth and the risk behaviors that end up persisting into the adulthood, I'm just asking myself as to how we can try and advise the religious leaders to work with everybody, including our local clinics and the traditional leaders, of course, so that we assist them with a tool. I don't know how we can assist them, but if we can have this, because these behaviors have been caused by all this abuse of alcohol and whatever, if we can end up having a tool that will end up assisting them, maybe if we get a machine that will detox whatever they will drink during the night, and tomorrow everything is out of their mind and their, so that they concentrate when they go to school. Because you just imagine Elena spending the whole weekend in Eshebim, and on Monday early in the morning take the books and go to school. What will happen? Obviously they'll end up fighting with their teachers, killing them, beating them, because they are under the influence of all these things that are not needed. So I just believe that God assisted you guys with the good cerebrum that will end up coming up with all these machines that will help us to detox everything that maybe goes into our bodies. I'm just worried about that. But if we can really work together with the religious leaders and all these people, maybe, I'm sure your response will be yes, we'll do that. It's not going to be no. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Honorable Tihani. So sorry for forgetting a very important province. It's important because I studied there, and Honorable Peters also was there. So thanks for the presentation. I heard you talking about a number of people who are around. Is there somebody who's an economist here amongst you? If none, it's okay.
So we have colleagues from the economics program, but none of us is a mainstream economist. But we would like to answer that question as far as we can.
I'll start with the wage bill. Because everybody comes and talk about it, I'll reserve my take on it. But I just want to check whether have we modeled the impact of the cut of the wage bill, of the wage bill, which is, you may want to read unemployment there. As you know, these things, they are not just confined. You do something here, it affects other things. For instance, an obvious thing, it's an impact on the revenues that SARS collects. Right, that's one of the things. And once we talk about that, everything remaining equal, the impact on the debt to GDP ratio doesn't improve. It worsens. So I'm just saying, it's one area that so that when we talk about these things, we approach them on a holistical things. We shouldn't behave as if it's a magic bullet and so on. These things, you do it here, it affects other thing, and so I just wanted to check that from your side, have you modeled that. Question number two, if the president were to decide tomorrow that a person by the name of HSRC is made a Minister of Finance, what is one biggest decision that you'll make? Lastly, I see there's a lot of either health researchers or people who love health, and that's for good reasons. You need a healthy society, because everything depends on that. We may have the best of programs. If we have got in a healthy nation, we won't be able to execute them. Is it not so? It is. Now, can you comment about the budget, right? Because there are many things which, how do we compare with other countries at our level of development as far as health allocation in the budget is concerned? Related to that, the problems that we are having in health, are they budgetary issues, or perhaps put differently? If we were to put in more money, do you think that we'll be able to solve, even if we say you give 100% of the budget to health, will those problems be solved? So the point perhaps that one is making is that do we really understand what the problems are? Let me just throw one that I know, that some of public sector medications, you find them in private sector doctors, and you don't know how they reach those private sector doctors. And secondly, there are even instances where you find a public sector medicine in the neighboring countries. So I'm just saying that's what informs my questions. Do we really understand what the problems are? What we need to do to try and improve our health services? Those would be my questions, and can I allow you to please respond to the questions and some of the comments that would have been made by the honorable members. Thank you. You'll decide on the, as long as you answer all our questions, we are dealing with one juristic person here, HSRC, as to how you distribute the questions amongst and between yourselves. It's your call.
Yeah. There are more than 20 questions, Jack. We'll take them in categories. So I'd like us to start with the economics questions. If after the economics questions we can go to the health questions, and then those 4-hour education types of questions, please, colleagues. But let me just start by saying so. First of all, our economists aren't amongst us, and we do have economists. We'd be quite happy to take some of those questions and get more detailed answers for you. But we do want to say, Chair, that these questions of particularly the macroeconomic nature and policies that we ought to be pursuing in the country are a subject of massive, massive debate, not just here, but globally. And so there's no categorical response that we can make to you to say that this is going to work or that's going to work. You have this really interesting example at the moment of the difference between Portugal and Spain, which were both subjected to austerity measures, and where recommendations were put in place about how these two countries are having to deal with circumstances very much as they are now having to deal with. Took very different approaches. And the major instrument that was suggested to both of them was to cut expenditure. One did and the other one did not. Portugal chose not to. And the result is very interesting. Now, it may not encompass all of the factors that are present in how the outcomes actually materialize. But Portugal is now in a better situation than, very interestingly, than Spain. Spain decided to go the austerity route and is dealing now with all of these difficulties of fiscal revenue streams and a diminished economy and is struggling. Portugal sits with that higher debt, but is managing that higher debt in ways that Spain can't. So it's not a straightforward question, your Chair, and it is an area in which we ought to be doing a great deal nationally. In Treasury, we ought to be doing a great deal more modelling, and that modelling is absolutely critical. We don't have enough econometric capacity in the country to be able to. So what is happening is that we're borrowing people from all over the place who are coming to advise us here. They don't understand our context. They make recommendations that don't deal with some of the base difficulties that we have, and we land up with solutions that are other people's solutions, not our own. And we ought to be working far more now together as a country, us, the universities, Treasury, around all of this space. I'll kick off with all of that, but I'd now like to ask our colleagues to, as crisply as they can, please, colleagues, answer these questions in these sections, and if there's anything left over, we'll pick them up. Thanks.
So I do apologise. Three senior colleagues who would have been better able to address some of the things I'm not here, but I will make a couple of points. One, the data in the first three slides. Slide two of the presentation is really very important, and we skipped over that, which shows our growth as an economy since 1992 and the flatlining in a number of areas from 2008, 2012 onwards. So to get a relative sense of performance, I think that really is quite important, and how the secondary and primary sectors were steadily growing till about the Marikana crisis. And after that, our service sector has grown moderately, but the other two sectors have really dipped. And I think in the longer term, that's quite an important perspective. Let me say that none of our own internal economists have analyzed and generated data around the debt question or the wage bill question here. So it's not based on our own modeling. It's basically based on picking up key issues in the budget speech and applying available data that we do have. So the concern about the debt, as I understand it, because I spoke to these gentlemen before they went off to the UK, etc., is that 60% is considered, in view of what Crane's saying, that's another debate, but about 60% is considered to be a manageable debt profile. The concern they have is the speed in which we are seeming to be able to rise from about 50 to 70, how compressed that is, and the longer term trajectory of that. That is so it's a ballooning debt thing. And as I say, it's not based on. In relation to the public wage bill, the issue there. I mean, I do apologize for these kind of sensational things like how many millionaires are in the public sector. I mean, I think that stuff is unnecessary. The main point there is that the increase over the last 10 years of that wage bill and the consequence of that for other aspects of basic service delivery as the point to focus on, okay? So the point of having, I totally appreciate having worked in the Eastern Cape at the University of Forte for the last 20 years, I totally appreciate what it really means to have skilled people working in a civil service in Vishu or at the, at the university, and what impact it can make in creating heroes like those that exist in the Springbok rugby team and so on, and how critical that is. But the point that is really is that as that wage bill increases, it does have an impact on, the service delivery function. That needs to be interrogated. That needs to be further interrogated. In terms of the other high-level kind of economic questions, really, a question about fourth industrial revolution. There's enormous concern and interest in this, and what its impact is going to be, and what the responses will be through education. And so on. The work that we have done there is relatively needs to be expanded. But I think as an organisation as a whole, the HSRC is really quite well positioned to expand work in that area through our work in education, safety, science and technology. We really want to be one of the leaders there. The data is showing for for us is that this opposition between industrialization and service sector specialization is a false dichotomy, that you have to actually do both and more is really the thing. And this idea that the kind of the crisis of inequality is embedded in the service sector is can be very true when you see around MIT in Boston, etc., enormously successful tech and millionaire billionaires emerging in the Silicon Valley. And so what happens is that states don't pay attention to this, because if this is properly managed and there's a proper social contract instead of public policies, that benefit doesn't have to end up being so spatially concentrated. And there are definite, it's definitely clear that America, in America in particular, these nodes of high wealth concentration have been the consequence of a lack of effective public policy, and that one can spread those benefits in important ways. And that's why I personally have been asking for very careful attention to be given to our university campus city precincts as areas that have potential for growth, but that the state needs to be involved in managing inclusion, opportunities, incentivizing things, ensuring that that talent is working. But I think that there are I think that's important. I think our organization, as Crane has pointed out, can really expand our expertise in this field of macroeconomics. I mean, I do think that Portugal's great success has a lot to do with its former colonial power. A lot of people go to Brazil, Mozambique, Angola. There's gold, there's oil, there's money that recirculates into that country in the way that Spain maybe doesn't have some of the opportunity. I think it's a complicated question. But that's... I also would like to say that there are, in the higher education system, universities like Stellenbosch and UCT and Pretoria and others that have a lot of expertise in these areas. And the question for the HSRC is, do we replicate what already exists in our higher education institutions, or do we, and this is what we're working on at the moment, establish a strong niche? And I think part of that niche might be in relation to public sector and some of these public sector concerns that
were raised
here today. I don't know whether I've answered anyone very effectively.
I just want to perhaps link onto the issue around the public sector wage bill, and I think the word pruning is an incorrect word. It's maximising our public sector spend. I think we can agree that if we have people sitting in post and not adding value to our state, to our nation-building enterprise, that's something to look at. And I think that in every one of our departments, there are different strengths and weaknesses. And I think the one suggestion in the slide was that we have some forms of audit or introspection or self looking at ourselves in terms of our own evaluation. And I think that the other important piece is, do we have space for redeploying people? You know, if we're really keen on the fact that we need more teachers, police, doctors, nurses in the public sector, and we have people in different areas, is there space for some of that redeployment? I think that's really important. And I think it's not a one-size-fits-all evaluation. And I really believe that in the same way as I'm sure there are committees looking at state-owned enterprises, they are not of equal value to our country and to our nation-building project. And I think they are going to have to be looked at separately, because one of the things about our state-owned enterprises, if we were to get rid of some of them, they will become, and they were to be profitable, they will be paying tax, they will be, you know, increasing the money into the system. And so, for example, the public broadcaster mustn't be seen in the same light as, sorry to say, it's SAA, because it serves different parts of our country. The public broadcaster, for example, has a big role to play in education in our country, and I think that must be taken into account when we look at, 200 state-owned enterprises that we have, and that needs to be taken into consideration in terms of looking at our economic prognosis.
Okay. There were several questions, several statements, several comments on health. But it would appear that NHI is on the top of all of our minds, as it should be. HIV and what it has done to the country is also on top of our minds. And fortunately, the issue of the youth risk behavior as well as the diabetes and hypertension. So essentially, you've covered everything. But your questions on the NHI, if the HSRC as a single organization could answer all those questions, then we wouldn't have a problem. So I'm not going to be dishonest. I can make some comments. I'm not speaking from an economic perspective, but I'm speaking from a public health perspective, because I'm a public health specialist, not an economist, and somebody who has worked in the health sector. So, yes, there are protagonists. There are those that support NHI and those that do not support NHI, and the various and for various reasons. And there have been many, many heated arguments. But the issue of NHI in South Africa actually hasn't started now. This was the poor white problem from the early 20s. And there's been a constant backlash on NHI historically. Much has been written about that. But I think, as I am definitely a supporter and a proponent of NHI, I think our constitution says it, you know, everybody has a right to health, everybody has a right to housing, and just to go back to the Freedom Charter, it's enshrined right in there. So, you know, a couple of schoolgirls came to speak to me about the NHI recently, and one of the questions was, Dr. Reddy, what is NHI? How do we see it in reality? We don't even understand what's NHI. Their parents don't support it, but they want to know what it is. And I thought that's really hopeful, and that's why we need the health services to be filled with young people. Because if you look at Cuba and the changes that Cuba made it possible. If you look at Brazil, it's done it in a different way, but it has done it. And those are the kinds of spaces we should be comparing ourselves. There was one question to start, and that question was, how much are we spending on NHI, on health in South Africa, and how does it compare to other countries? The last time I looked, and I could be a little bit wrong, and we're spending about 8.5% to 9% of our GDP on health. That's not a small amount of money, colleagues. It's a huge amount of money. Compared to countries like India, you know, we're doing really, really well. Compared to Brazil, we're doing really, really well. We cannot compare ourselves to the North. The problems here are historical, and it's a problem of inequality and gross neglect. And health is an investment. It's not a tap that's flowing into the ocean. Health has to be seen in an investment. Otherwise, all the things my colleagues are talking about here just can't happen if adults and children don't have their health. Then you asked issues about the NHI pilot sites. The HSRC had submitted a proposal to evaluate the pilot sites. We were not successful. Several of us were part of those bids. The pilot evaluation was done by Genesis, PwC, and some other private agencies, including foreign agencies. I'm not very clear how the pilot sites were funded. But what we know, now to go back to the girls and the question they asked, the framework is the NHI. But what is the operational face? How is it going to look like in the clinic? How is it going to look like in the community? How is it going to look like in the ambulance? How is it going to look like when it relates to a school, for example, a rural community, an urban community? So let's go back to the pilot site. Remember, there were 11 or 12 pilot sites. Okay, and it took one. We can look at the rollout of the pilot sites in several ways, but one of it can be the rollout of the ideal clinics. Okay, and the ideal clinics were thought of in the beginning, when I was early involved in it, was there was a set of standards that were set by WHO for low and middle income countries and wherever we are in the whole chain. And the way that the methodology was that there would be about 3,400 clinics selected. But when we look at the report that was released when the Minister of Health spoke not so long ago, only about 1,500 attained the standard that they should have attained the standard. What we also know is that they claim that those 14 pilot sites screened 4.5 million children, which is fantastic because screening is the start. However, we don't know how many of them received glasses, hearing aids, and whatever therapies they had to receive. So the findings from those reports are rather mixed. And so where are we now? What do we do with the results? From an HSRC perspective, I think we have the skills and the capacity to assist the government in creating demonstration projects, and we did so, unfortunately, with foreign funding, and we worked in two NHI areas, in one in Bumiblobo district and one in the Northern Cape in Dar. And we focused on two small areas. Well, I say small, they're not small. We focused on hypertension and diabetes. And some of the lessons that we learned from our project, and that would be similar to other findings that other work that has been done. So, for example, the despecialization of sophisticated cardiovascular disease treatment knowledge, the despecialization on issues around diabetes and hypertension can be re-engineered for community health workers to do. So, for example, we worked in those areas, we assisted government, we trained more community health workers, and we were able to successfully screen over 11,000 people for diabetes and hypertension, and that's somewhere in the slides there. How we go forward is, you know, the national plans are there, the Department of Health is doing it, but I think we will not be able to go forward if both the private sector and the government sector don't collaborate and this political will is expedited to move forward. I know the comments are rather broad. We can discuss this in details in other forums. We'll be willing to present the findings in detail and look at how we could fix it. The final issue is, I think it's the issue of infrastructure, equipment, and skilling resources. And we have to look at creative ways of doing that. But that's similar for the education sector. So it's we're not saying anything new, but I think the HSRC can be drawn into that kind of work.
Sorry, Chair, can I have a follow-up on that?
I don't think you, thank you very much for that, but I don't think you've answered my question. And the reason why I'm asking, I'm one of them that supports the NHI in its entirety, to be honest with you, because I believe in equal health care for everybody. In your research and whatever you've done, do you believe that in terms of when we are supposed to roll it out, are we ready for it? Or do you think there's a lot more that needs to be done for us to achieve that? Because your input is going to help us as committees to be able to drive this process and see that the deadline that we set, we will be able to meet them. We don't want to come to the deadline and find we're not ready to roll these things out.
But, you see, again, it's how we define readiness and how we do preparedness. So I would say to just roll out across the country, no, it won't work. But if we go from district to district, and as we learned there, out of the 3,500 clinics, or we were able to do it with 1,500 clinics, then we've got to go back there. I think it's going to be an iterative process. We're going to learn, we're going to go four steps forward, two steps back. And that's what we as a nation are going to have to be prepared to do. And of course there are major issues with redistribution of the framework as well as the skills. And we must also remember that at least 40% of our trained doctors and perhaps nurses and other healthcare workers left the country. So without spending too much, how do we keep our doctors and our nurses and other health professionals in the country? You know, when you're sending a young couple into a rural area and there's no house for them, and these are trained people who spend a lot of money at medical school, you know, it was the issue that you were saying, Honourable Member, about, you know, raising people out of the dust and giving them a decent space to live. I think there's all those cultural and ethical barriers that the Department of Health has to take and face and move forward as well. I know I haven't answered all the detailed questions, but I don't have the answers.
Thank you. Just to add on how much we are spending on health relative to other countries, particularly in Africa. There is actually an agreement as part of the Abuja Declaration by the AU, which set as a standard 15% of the country's budget. So we haven't gotten to that. Very few countries, maybe there could be the odd one. I want to volunteer a name, probably a neighbor to our north, Botswana, be closer to that. But the rest of the countries are struggling to meet that 15% because it's a whopping amount. Again, the sizes of our economies do differ. So what's 15% for South Africa is a lot of money. Right. And in terms of the allocation to towards the HIV AIDS problem, the South African government does allocate up to 80% of what we spend on HIV. The rest comes from donor funding. The reverse is the situation in a lot of the other countries on the African continent, with the exception again of Botswana. So in fact, our government, through Parliament, has been really doing a commendable job. If I could just add one other thing on the issue of prevention. One member did allude to the fact that perhaps we are not doing as much prevention with regard to HIV/AIDS as we can. One interesting aspect is actually a way in which we could actually prevent more infections is through successful treatment, because it lowers the viral load so that even if you are living with HIV, if you are successfully being treated, you are no longer able to pass on the virus to others. So yes, we kind of treating ourselves also as prevention. It's called treatment as prevention. However, there are aspects in the National Strategic Plan for HIV, AIDS, TB, STIs and TB. The weakest link, in my view, is we have been struggling with coming up with social interventions where we address issues to do with norms, social norms. These are these long-standing practices which are cultural. They come way back. But if I could touch on a closely related issue here, the issue of alcoholism. There is something that's called binge drinking, which happens really a lot in countries like South Africa and neighboring countries relative to elsewhere in the world. Perhaps the Russians do as well. This is getting drunk to get drunk. You drink to get drunk. And in our context, this is really multifaceted in that part of what drives that is also, for example, the unemployment situation. If you're sitting day in, day out at home and have nothing to do, it's really drinking is the only other thing that you can do. So I think we cannot actually abolish drinking per se. This culturally in this part of the world is something that we accept, but it's really about how we teach people to drink responsibly. And there are some programs which have been developed along those lines. Maybe let me stop there.
Yeah. On the issue of alcohol like tobacco, it's an issue of supply and demand. And, you know, with tobacco, we have been successful in legislation. And I think in alcohol, some of that kind of thinking has to be considered. because you can change. You can change people's you know, behavior. You can change what they want. But if you have a big industry pumping it continually from 6 a.m. in the morning to, you know, 24/7, and its access is very easy, then kids are going to do it. So I don't think it's just a personal behavior. We also need to look at what I would call the commercial determinants.
Chairperson, can I ask, Heidi, if you'll please just do the gender-based violence question?
Well, I mean,
just
I think...
Hang on.
Sorry.
And also this question about sex education, please, sexuality. Or do you want to do that, please? Priscilla?
No one wants to talk about it. So I'll take the hot potato. And I think I want to make 2 points on gender-based violence. And I think what's come up in the conversation is where I think, whether that's gender-based violence, whether that's education, whether that's health, our work has to do with going back to the hard issues. And we don't want to deal with that 25 years in. We thought they're going to be easy solutions, right? We thought there should be SEER springing up everywhere, and they're not. SEER is an exceptional case. The fact that he is an exceptional case is our problem. We have to get the root causes right. We have to address those inequalities that make him so exceptional. And that goes for health, that goes for gender-based violence, that goes for education. The issue of sexuality education in schools is uncomfortable for all of us. And I think we have to deal with our discomfort. HIV and its risks are not going away. The rise in incidence in that young population is telling us that we're not doing some things right. And so it means we have to go to those discomforting places, whether that's gender-based violence, whether that's sexuality education. And it means we have to look at ourselves. And as I was saying when I was talking about gender-based violence, we don't want to do that work. We want somebody else to do that work. Government to solve that problem. Teachers to solve that problem of HIV and sexuality. But it's our work. And so I think 25 years in, for me, that's the reality of this country, the extent to which we all have to roll up our sleeves. We all have to be doing that hard work in our own lives. The extent to which, as men and women, we uphold these norms that make it okay for men to continue to treat women the way they do, that make it okay for women like ourselves to say she shouldn't be out there at that time of the night and then cry when something happens to her. So those are the norms that circulate, that are inside of us, that we support, that we adhere, we pass on to our children. That's where the hard work is. We have to look at ourselves. We have to do that work. And we must address these big structural problems, these big structural inequalities. Otherwise, we will never find ourselves ahead of these issues that we've pointed out to you today.
Thanks. Can I ask Charlene, if you deal with ECD and this robotics and also basic education binary, please, and there was one more.
We should put our priority around technology.
Robotics.
So thank you, Colin, for your questions. And I think the one issue for me around education is that we expect so much from our teachers. We need to acknowledge that, from sex education through to coding and robotics, through to all sorts of things that we expect from our teachers. And one of the things that the minister has said repeatedly is that under her tenure, she hasn't wanted to change the curriculum, because under each previous minister, we've had curricular changes. And so the thing that seems to be absent in looking at the issue of educational quality and all of these questions that you've raised today is, do we have a strategic roadmap for education in our country for the next 25 years? And I want to suggest that the answer is that we don't. We have lots of initiatives. And I think it could be a function of this committee to ask the minister, to ask the portfolio committee, what is the strategic plan in terms of all of these priorities together? Because if we want our students to learn artisanal skills and how to put a microwave back together again, as well as coding and robotics, as well as increasing the higher the pass mark,
we've actually got to put those things all together and decide what we have the capacity to do with our current cadre of teachers, with our current resources, and I think that's really important. And in that, in answering it in that way, I'm saying no, the quality of education is not yet strong enough. 33% is not a high enough pass rate. Of course it isn't. The question of ECD, I have been on the HSRC staff for 10 years. Every year when we've made this presentation to this committee, we've spoken about the importance of ECD. This year we didn't because grade R is now strictly compulsory, and so we think we've won. However, we're going to have lots and lots of young people who are not going to go to grade R. And so that's that same question is, are we going to leave people behind by focusing on making grade R or compulsory when so many of our young people for the next 5 or 6 years are still not going to get to grade R? And it's the same question that we had to face when we spoke about broad-based black economic empowerment. We hoped that it would have risen people on the tide, and we've seen that it hasn't been the case. And so when it comes to education, I really believe with great respect that we can't push so far ahead because we will leave people behind. And so we've got to focus on getting some of those basics right. And the issue of doing things simultaneously, I want to say, has an alternative methodology. Massive open online courses, we use them in universities, but we could use our public broadcaster to help young people get a vision for robotics and coding. We really could. We could use data access for young people in Guletu and Langa and ability to get different kinds of smartphones for them to do YouTube videos on data and robotics and coding and those kinds of things. We don't have to look to our education system to do absolutely everything. Mm. We can look to alternatives through civil society and through, for example, the public broadcaster. And I think that's really important. And that last question about where we should be putting our technological priorities, for me, the thing that we haven't spoken about is TVETs. We really need to reimagine TVETs and getting young people who are inclined towards the more technical and mechanical to start becoming more inclined towards the technologically technical and mechanical. Mm. And that will solve enormous numbers of problems in our country going forward. But we haven't given enough effort and focus on TVETs in our country, and that's certainly something that should be part of a strategic educational roadmap going forward.
Thanks. I'm going to ask let me just answer an Honourable Member Shank's question about it's not the pass rate, it's the pass requirement. It's the requirements for what the pass rate should be. And simply to say to you, Mr. Shaikh, that it's not a cut and dried question, because 50% in South Africa may mean 40% in another country, may mean 30% in another. So it's what that 50% actually means that I think that we should be paying attention to. What is in that basket of requirements which are being stipulated? And I think once we're clear about that, then we can have a discussion. But the discussion is framed in very symptomatic terms. 50 looks okay, 30 looks really bad, and I do think that there is a thing in our public discussion around improving that public discussion around understanding actually what is at stake. And so I'd urge us all to be clear about what is it that is being spoken about. I do want to say to you, though, that it does sound bad. and that we in those terms should be really careful. But I'm going to ask
can I just follow up on that one?
Yeah.
I want us to be mindful when you say that, on the fact that I think it is 80% of the surgeons have all failed the examination a few weeks ago. So that's where I'm coming from in terms of that. If the quality is not good at that level, this is what you're going to produce at the end. Almost 80%, I think, failed the other day.
Yeah, so that was a very useful, that was a useful conversation to be had. Because the benchmarking of what a surgeon should be manifesting in his or her training is benchmarked not in an arbitrary way. And so the fact that your people are failing there is actually a very good marker of, in that particular case, a very good marker of holding on to you know, what your requirements are. And so people must be held to account around all of that. That discussion has been very badly handled, I'd like to say, also, you know, from a public point of view.
I think I'm just going to reflect on the methodology for the survey quickly.
Can you also talk about the question about public participation?
I'm going to talk about it. But in terms of the methodology, it's a nationally representative survey. It's stratified by province, by race, geographic location. And within that then, you're using the primary sampling units. We sample households, and within the household, we randomly select a member of that household to be interviewed. So it's representative of the entire population in short. But I mean, I can provide details of the methodology of how the survey has been conducted.
So it's
not a telephone survey, it's face-to-face. People are visited in their household at the time that's convenient for them. Okay. In terms of, I think, public participation, we've done a project for the Department of Public Service and Administration, which we call the Citizen Scorecard Project. Now, in that project, we brought community members together with public officials, and they had to identify key concerns and issues around water and electricity, and we did this in Nyanga a few years back. So what we've learned from that people put their issues on the table, we bring them together, they discuss the issues using the water, the street committees, to select people to work with it. And then at the end of the day, what we found that once people have put that on the table, they negotiated, they talk together, they understand each other, and we solve quite a big couple of issues. So much so that when there's an electricity problem, people have stolen the cables, etc., the community members will phone the electricity department and say, don't come now, there's a riot or there's something wrong here, because that is a big cost saving to the state with dispatching vehicles unnecessarily. But for us, that was a big investment in terms of the funding from DPSA. What needs to happen further is to scale up this process, to use other technologies like social media, et cetera, so that people within the community are made aware of the existing structures, they're being informed about issues. So there is a need to do that. So that brought, I would say, government and city officials closer to the public. There are many such examples, but I mean, I must acknowledge that the street, you guys know that the ward committees, etc., these are very complicated. People also don't have the time and the energy sometimes to interact with these communities. People work late, and sometimes we find it's only the unemployed and women really that participated sometimes in these platforms. So it is a complex, it is a difficult situation, but I think there needs to be kind of those models roll out within the communities. I know the parliamentary offices are there, but that is not so effective, we know that. So I do think we need to use what we've learned from that process. If you work with existing structures and you get buy-in, it's at a broader scale. But that report is also available.
And you, Chairperson, have asked this question about what the HSRC would do if it were to be given this responsibility, the Minister of Finance, and what decision it would make. I wouldn't like to answer that question, simply because I think we're in a really difficult position, and I think we must acknowledge that now in terms of priorities. I think that the President's integrated district implementation process is a really important process, which all of us should be looking at finding ways of making work. That integration of spending and implementation plans across departments is a really crucial one, because we see how what decisions get taken in one department get completely, if you like, neutralized by a decision taken in another department, and so the good intentions of our policy by and large are completely overcome by a lack of understanding of how you come to deal with a problem. You know, so problems must be dealt with in integrated kinds of ways. You know, we need integration between health and education in far better ways than we actually see, Chairperson. And it's if it comes down to the issues. I think the issue is about making policy work and our inability to be able to understand how to be better implementers of the commitments that we make. Now, I know that doesn't answer your question, but I'd like to say that if pushed to think about what the macroeconomic future of the country, you know, should be all about, it has to be in this direction of working together in ways that we don't.
Check it
out, Bobo. I want to propose, Chair, that look, this is our first bite with HSR. We are in the first leg towards the many years of the sixth administration. We will be together here. So I want to challenge HSRC Chair to your office that, having noted our concerns and questions and all, you don't just say today you are unable to deal with all and stop. But then we welcome that you go back, debate more on these issues, and perhaps submit a discussion document of some kind where you would have, you know, went out to dig more on some of the issues, and then such could be channeled through the committee secretary. Thanks, Chair.
Any other input from other members? Anybody will die if he doesn't or she doesn't come in? No. Okay. Just to summarize, I think you got the issues which are bothering the honourable members, so which should also help you to start helping us to think about some of these problems and challenges which are facing us as a country. If I come to one or two concluding remarks, just to enrich your inputs, especially when you are dealing with a committee like us, which you are meeting for the first time, it's very important to say in your introduction, who's HSRC? Right. Who are you? What's your responsibility? And why are you here? You know, I do have answers, but I think it's very important to hear it from yourselves. But for me, again, I think just to briefly touch on, because for instance, as you can see, that we are throwing things to you that perhaps we expect you to research on and so on. I think you do want to talk about your budget and who funds you. I think you want to take us on board. I think it will help us on to make a number of opinions. Okay, so I just thought let me mention that we're talking about ourselves as the committee. We appropriate money. I usually say to people, the Minister of Finance proposes to Parliament. What you see, he proposes until Parliament decides on that. It's not the budget. So we are the subcommittee of, if you like, from a company point of view, we are the subcommittee of Parliament. So when that proposal comes to Parliament about how they want to spend the money, it comes to us. And this type of information is also going to help us and reach us, arm us to make sure that some of the interventions that we're also making are scientifically informed. So that's other thing. So one big concern you'd have seen from the types of questions that were coming from the honourable members, that we're so much concerned about the impact of the money that we appropriate. It's well and good to know that we're taking so much, it's going to this department, it's going to this, and so on. But at the end of the day, we're not going to be measured about the billions and trillions that we appropriate. We're going to be measured about the impact that we make to
to the lives of South Africans, mm-hmm. especially to deal with the challenges of the triple challenges of our country: unemployment, inequality, and poverty. So it's very important that that's what drives us at the end of the day. It's well and good to see, and obvious to see, that that money is being effectively and efficiently used. And if it's effectively and efficiently used, we'll see with the impact that it has. Because we'll continue coming here, it becomes one and the same thing, we meet and so on and so forth. So that's what, so when it comes to the type of research, you must always have that at the end of at the back of your mind, that the concern and what we are trying to help us is to ensure that we improve the impact of what we do and to understand exactly where the challenges are, so that we can better our interventions on those things. CEO, I think you I don't know whether it's you, but from your team, you spoke about the type of research that we go out and get people, and then you made the Herculean assumption. You said we don't have econometric modeling skills. I must check the statement. I don't think so. But I think the bright point that you have also made is that perhaps we rely so much on people who do not, outside us, who do not understand the context. Because when it comes to this, the context is so important. It's very important, and so on and so forth. So let's also try to deal with that. It's what can be done? I think we do have. You mentioned the universities that were heavy gear and so on and so forth. But sometimes we jump those people and go somewhere. And if we don't have skills, we are this institute, and how can you help perhaps to make sure that we enhance those skills? But from my perspective is that one, we do have, perhaps we don't use them. And for me, research and context very 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 much they go hand in hand. But with those a few comments from my side, and thank you very much, honourable members, for the interaction and the questions you ask. As I said, it just tends to things which concern us. CEO and your team, thank you very much, honourable. Lizana said, this is not an event. When you come next time, don't make us ask you the very same question. Be proactive and say, by the way, these are the types of questions that we asked before. That's what we have done. We don't expect you to have done everything under the sky, but we want to see that there is progress that we are making. But thank you very much, honourable members. Thank you very much on this session. We'll continue with our agenda. As a committee, we don't chase people away. If you want to see how we deal with our things, you may remain, but I'm sure you are free to leave if you so prefer. Thank you
thank you
very
you.
Much. Honourable members, thank you so much. Let's continue with our agenda. Why I was stressing the question of context to researchers, human science research council. For instance, your classical economists will tell you that minimum wage works against employment creation. Come and do that and so on. But without knowing where we're coming from and where for instance, this unemployment takes a racial line in South Africa and so on, and so it's very easy to come and say, take this thing away. I think that's but let's continue interacting with them. So we are now on agenda item number 5. We're dealing with the minutes. Let's make sure that we're hitting our minutes. We've got 4 sets of minutes. We've got minutes of the 22nd. Yes. 22nd October, right? Minutes of the 23rd of October. We have that. 5th of November, we have that. 6th of November, you have that. And 11th of November. Can I get an indication from other members that they do have those sets of minutes?
11th of November.
What? Sorry. It's No, there's no 11th of November. I'm putting in a document which doesn't belong. 6th of November is the last set of minutes. Okay, can we go to the minutes of the 22nd of October 2019? Page 1, 2, 3, 4. I take it that we read the minutes. Can I have the mover for the adoption of the minutes? Honorable Clara, Honorable Kaiso, seconded. Minutes of the 22nd of October 2019 adopted. Minutes of the 23rd of October 2019, page 1, 2. I'm just allowing you if at least you there's something that you. Yes, Honorable Kaiso.
I think there's a. I read the wrong date here of the 22nd. I'm not supposed to move there.
Yes.
I'm just proposing to withdraw that move.
Okay. Honorable Kaiso, did you move or did you second? You second. Can Transmatafu also attempt to second the minutes of the 22nd of October? Okay. Seconded and adopted. Thank you. 23rd of October 2019, page 1. I'm just allowing you in case you scribble something. 2, 3, 4, 5. Can we move the adoption of the minutes of the 23rd of October? Honorable Joseph, second up. Honorable Kumane, second. Thank you. Minutes of the 5th of November, page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 5th of November. Kaiso, Matafa, seconded. Thank you. minutes of the 6th of November, page 1. 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes.
Let us call it the number 4.
Page number 5.
Item number 4.
Item number, yes.
Yes, the date of the meeting on the 10th of October. The proposal for adoption is not RE, but RN.
Yes. RN. Thank you, Honorable Kumane. Page 5. Page 6. Can move for the adoption of the minutes of the 6th of November 2019 as a true reflection of that meeting. Matafa, Komani?
Yes,
okay. And adopted. Okay. Thank you so much. That takes care of the minutes. It was agenda item number 5. Then can we go to agenda item number 6? Honorable members, I think it's more for noting. We remember we had in our interaction with ESCOM around the question of the auditors and staff information. We had asked them to write to us. There's a letter that they've written as a response to that. Can we note that that correspondence? Thank you. So we'll note the correspondence. Then go to agenda item number 7. I'll ask the secretary to take us through the program, because the updated committee program.
Thank you, Chairperson. The changes to the program, they relate to the meetings to be held on the 20th and the 26th and the 27th of November. We have, in consultation with the Chairperson, we've identified departments to be invited for hearings on the Investments Appropriation Bill. These departments were identified with the help of the committee researcher. The departments are as follows. On the 20th, we will see the Department of Transport. On the 26th, we will be meeting with the Budget and Finance Committee from the Kenyan Parliament. And then thereafter, we will be meeting with the Department of Health and Adjustments Appropriation Bill. On Wednesday, the 27th of November, we will be meeting with two departments. It's the Department of Water and Sanitation, as well as the Department of Cooperative Governance. That is on the Adjustments Appropriation Bill. What we can do there, Chairperson, we can give each department 2 hours, an hour to, or half an hour to present, and then hour and a half to deliberate. Those are the only changes to the program, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Zamisa, do you want to talk to why with those departments identified?
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson, and greetings, honorable members. Basically, these departments were identified due to the major adjustments that were affected on them during the adjustment budget process. Those are the proposed adjustments. The most important thing in these departments, significant underspending. You know, funds have already been declared unspent 6 months to the financial year, so those departments are affected. And then other issues, per department, for instance, the Department of Cogs, the underspending is mainly on the community works program, which we think is a very important program in terms of poverty alleviation and so on. And then underspending on the municipal systems, a grant, which is a grant that is intended to intervene in municipalities that have got low capacity. So if they are not spending on that grant, it definitely means their interventions in assisting municipalities is not effective, and we thought that the committee really needs to discuss those issues. And the other issues in this department is very key in coming up with like interventions in the issue of municipalities that owe ESCOM and municipalities that are owed by other government departments. And we seem to not see any progress in that respect. So we thought it's very important before issues of protest towards the local government elections that are coming, before those things happen, this department must come. And then Department of Water and Sanitation, yeah, underspending a lot. And then there's this issue of a water crisis in the country, and we want to know, do they have the financial capacity to respond to those issues? And then if the adjustments that have been affected on their budget does really assist them to respond to the current crisis. And over and above that, we had issues that we discussed with this department during the 5th Parliament, and we think this is an opportunity to follow up on those issues, such as the implementation of the War on Leaks program. There was a lot of poor spending there, overspending on the budget, and beneficiaries not getting their money, and the department said they would resolve this issue and come back to the committee. So that's the opportunity, and we had an oversight to Bloemfontein, Free State, to check the progress in the eradication of bucket toilets. Many issues were identified there. There was no progress. The department said they will make some progress, and then I think that's the opportunity also to discuss those issues. And then the Department of Transport, Chair, it's mainly the issue of PRASA, the low investment in capital projects. You know, we know the issues that are facing the trains in South Africa and so on and so forth. So this is an opportunity to discuss that issue, because the Department of Transport is a shareholder department of PRASA, but also there's a lot of underspending, especially the tax recapitalization grant in many other areas. And then it's Department of Health, Chair. A lot of underspending, especially on NHI grants, and the Parliament is busy with the NHI grant process. So the state of readiness, I think this department must really respond to that, and many other issues, Chair. Thank you very much.
Honorable Komani.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair President, acknowledging what has been said by our researcher. Maybe in question, can maybe, because we are new in this committee, in this parliament, can there be maybe notes or information be made available to us so that we can know where the 5th parliament has ended, so that we can be able to be taken? So thank you very much.
Thank you. Honourable Chair, how did you read my mind? Because that was going through my mind. There's a sangoma here. Okay, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Not on the program. I just stopped short on the 27th, but the 28th is a caucus day normally. So I just want clarity on that morning. I see the next day there's a meeting on the 28th, so I just want clarity on that. But the rest of the program is fine.
Yes, Chairperson, that meeting will commence at 12:30 after caucus. We have to schedule it on the Thursday of the 28th, because the debate on the revised fiscal framework will be taking place on the Wednesday, and we can't formally consider the adjustments appropriation if the revised fiscal. It's 12:30. It's 12:30. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other clarification? Yeah, I think, as I missed the question of lifting up those things that we must follow up on, and which are things which are also coming up from the expenditure up to the second quarter. Let's have those things and make them available to the honourable members. Honourable members, you know, it always helps if we point at one thing. Can we, just as this committee, the question of bucket system, if by the time we leave Parliament, we say at least that one we can say we've ticked it and so on. That thing is so dehumanizing. And if people don't spend on that, even if it means that every other second month we go and visit because we're saying we have appropriate money for that and see what happens and make sure that that's done. I'm just, there are many other important things, but I'm just saying this thing, it's such an embarrassment for a country which has got over 1.4 trillion rand. We can't get rid of a bucket system. I think it's an indictment against all of us. Honorable Kaison.
Yeah, I agree with this proposal. I think if we can make a performance, if we can make this a performance, a part of performance contract of an HOD, so that we know whose network will be played next. Because we can't even punish our own people because there was no performance. But if you can ask give instruction that whoever that is developing that must make a performance, part of performance contract of that HOD, such that now really in 6 months there must be a very serious progress that we receive as a committee specifically to that area. So if we say Bloemfontein, you say we give you 6 months to have a serious progress. In fact, I don't think we have to, there must be a serious progress. It sounds like an old record when we go to our people again and make an excuse. You can't make an excuse, you can't afford to make an excuse moving towards 1921. So if we can, I just think abroad that let's a command that there has to be a performance, it should be part of the performance contract of the person that is responsible, that thing. As we will be given some deadlines, we must work on deadlines now, no more stories, and we must give a very stern warning on that day when we meet with those people that we really could break your neck.
Thank you. Switch off your app. Can we, when we write to water and sanitation, the letter should say, amongst other things, they should give us a program and time frames of dealing with the bucket system challenge, the eradication of bucket system. That should be there. When they come in, they must present a proper program and timelines by such and such a time. This will be done, so that we hold them responsible to that. That should happen. I think if we need to move resources and so on, just that one. For me, Honorable Kaiso, elections or no elections, it's the right thing for us to do. I think we owe that to our people to say we may not be able to deal with many other things, but this one. Okay. Thank you, honourable members. But yes.
Chair, just for clarity, is that for the next meeting when we see them?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
They must come with that thing so that Sizo Yeke is stamped. We have got deadlines and say that's what's going to happen. And then when we communicate to our people, we say these are the deadlines and so on and so forth. And obviously, with the consequences, if that doesn't happen, Honorable Kaiso, right? I think we need to do that. Goris, just to share with you this question of underspending on budgets. Well, obviously, the main impact of that is that the core mandate is not delivered. But these things have got a bigger impact on the macro economy. For instance, if you don't spend, every department which underspends, it's contributing to us not reaching the economic growth, the GDP growth that you spoke about. Because if you don't spend in the GDP equation, we've got a part which says government will be spending, and you don't underspend on that one, you affect your economic growth. You are contributing to employment creation, or unemployment rate that we're having. So this, at a micro level, it does have an impact, but the bigger impact, and you take all these departments who are not spending money that has been appropriated, it affects, it deals with your GDP. We don't reach the GDP level that we speak about. We undershoot as far as employment inflation is concerned. But again, the debt to GDP ratio that we always speak about, that everybody speaks about, gets affected about that. If you talk about the debt to GDP ratio, you have got the debt on top and GDP. So there are two ways you are going to decrease that ratio. It's either by decreasing the debt or by increasing the GDP. Your debt to GDP ratio gets affected by that. So people may be doing these things in their small ways and so on. They affect the bigger macroeconomic. The problem with most of the inputs that we get, it's only concentrating on one part of this debt to GDP. That's why everybody talks about cutting, without dealing with the GDP, which is also very important. If you increase it, you are decreasing your debt to GDP ratio. So I'm just saying that people may not be aware about the massive negative impact their underspending is having on the macroeconomic framework and fiscal sustainability, so to speak. I just thought let me mention that as a part of my closing remarks. And before I was just talking to Darren about the debates that we are still going to have. We must just get. For instance, we must still debate the 2019 Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, 2019 MTBVS, 2019 Adjustments Appropriations Bill, oversight report to be introduced after adoption by the committee. So there are still all those things, and I've requested Darren to get us the dates exactly and to what we're doing so that we may know how to prepare ourselves for those debates. Am I correct? Do you want to say something?
Chair, you didn't ask for exact dates, but the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill is going to be debated next week, Wednesday. We are adopting our reports on Tuesday, our report on Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. And then for the other two, the Adjustments Appropriation and the MTBVS, it's the last debate. It's in this first week in December. And then there's also the Oversight Report, but I don't think that one is going to be debated. That's just the introduction and then declarations. Thanks, Chair.
So next week we're having the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill coming on. Okay. So let's deal with that. Honourable members, thank you so much. Hi, Honourable Chosen.
Just a question, that information be shared with us on email as well.
Thank you. Please, Darren, just share that information with the honourable members. These debates or declarations that may still come, but the ones who are very clear on that, there will be debates on. So please share that with the honourable members. Okay. That takes us to the end of the meeting. Thank you very much, honourable members.